Whoa! You! Hello!
Chair Barker is testifying. He'll be in a little bit. He said, go ahead and start. We'll do it. We're going to start public hearing. We're going to start with House Bill 2554. Representative Springer, will you come up, please, and go ahead, Shannon, read the bill.
House Bill 2554 expands the definition of vulnerable user of a public way to include any farm tractor or implement of husbandry.
Thank you very much. Representative Springer, thank you.
Well, thank you. For the record, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. And you're all wondering why I brought my son's toys up here. Actually, they're not my son's. I borrowed these from a good friend. But this is what I want to talk to you about today. And in 2007, this legislature passed House Bill 3314, which became the Vulnerable Vehicle Law. And let me just back up a little bit from that. July 28th of this last year, actually just about 5 miles from my home, one of our neighbors was driving his brother's haystacker. Big, quite frankly, ugly piece of equipment that is very awkward, quite frankly. And he, of course, was going from one field to the next, dairy farmer out there, crossed the road, and there was an accident. A log truck came up and struck the vehicle. I'm not here to discuss who was at fault. I think that's still being investigated. That's not the point of this bill. But unfortunately, Nathan Gourley was killed as a result of that accident. And so we started some meetings, and the community, of course, called me, and we talked about this, and we wanted to come up with something that would certainly help prevent this from ever happening again. Now, we all know we can't make laws to prevent bad things from happening always, but we do need to reexamine what we are doing and if they're appropriate. So I was introduced to House Bill 3314 from 07, the Vulnerable Vehicle Law, and I looked at that, and what jumped out at me immediately was four words that we're going to talk about today: without an enclosed shell. And so the bill before you, 2554, simply removes those four words, without an enclosed shell. As you can see here, we have our combines, we have our harvesters, we have all these great implements, and everything you see here, you see up and down the road many times, certainly in my district, all the time. I see caravans of these going up and down the road in July for, a good 2 weeks, 3 weeks. But out of all of these tractors, this is the only one that the law applies to. Nothing else up here is a vulnerable vehicle. And I realize they have shells that keep the air conditioning in, which I would want, and keep the dust out, which I would want. But what we're talking about is a vehicle that is incredibly large, incredibly noisy, and is very hard to see around. And I believe that that's what creates the vulnerable status here. So I bring this bill to you and encourage that you consider this and those four words, without an enclosed shell. Those four words, whether they were in the law or out of the law, would not affect Nathan Gourley and the Gourley family. However, as we met and we discussed this over several weeks, it became clear that we really have two approaches to this issue. And number one is we need to continue the Share the Road message. And number two, we need to make sure that the legislation we have in place appropriately addresses this issue at hand. You know, and there's been a little bit of conversation about these big things driving down the road and slowing us down, and they slow me down because half my commute every single day is where these guys drive. And I have to time myself, quite frankly, depending on the season. But agriculture is such an integral part of our economy that they deserve some honor. They deserve some status. There was, OSU has done a research, and according to their survey, agriculture comprises approximately 9% of the state's gross state product, 10% of jobs, and 9% of value-added manufacturing. And certainly as people are coming in my office, and probably your office by the loads right now, and we talk about different pieces of legislation, I'm asking the question, what does this do about jobs? And this is also a jobs issue. So certainly, I appreciate your time today. If you have any questions, I'd feel would welcome those. And I know there's a couple other people behind me that are experts in this area that want to talk about it.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, committee? Very
great
good.
Collection.
And no, you can't have the toys.
Yeah.
My grandson.
Two grandsons, yeah.
Thank you very much for bringing this to us.
Thanks.
And we'll ask Mr. Russell and Mr. Cleve to come up, please. Help. You need some help? We're just going to leave them there.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. I attended the town hall meeting with Representative Springer with the Gorley family and their neighbors earlier this summer. And certainly, I worked on this particular bill in 2007, and I think that it was clearly an oversight the way we drafted the bill with respect to farm machinery. And I think this fixes it, and I think it's a very positive thing, and we support it.
Thank you very much.
For the record, my name is Sean Cleve. I represent Oregon Farm Bureau on a variety of issues, including transportation. I'm here today to support the bill from the Farm Bureau's perspective. We represent roughly 8,000 farming and ranching families in Oregon. There are about 12,000 farming and ranching families that Oregon Department of Agriculture has identified. So we represent quite a big swath of those people who engage in agricultural activities professionally. We do have, as Rep. Springer suggested, quite an impact on Oregon's economy, but we're also a very small percentage of the overall population. And one of the things, unfortunately, that accompanies that is people don't always pay enough attention on the road to some of these vulnerable vehicles. And during the summer months in the Willamette Valley, and frankly statewide, there are near misses on an hourly basis, I'm sure. So just to be brief, we really appreciate the work that the representative has put in on this bill. We think it's a step in the right direction, and we appreciate Oregon truckers also supporting the legislation.
Okay, further any questions, comments? Thank you.
We're ready to close the hearing. Okay. We do not yet have a fiscal impact statement on this.
Okay.
So.
Close the hearing on House Bill 2554. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2285.
House Bill 2285, we're on the Dash 2 amendments, and they replace the bill in its entirety. The Dash 2 amendments close a loophole in the drug crime statutes that left delivery of more than an ounce of marijuana for no consideration and unclassified and uncriminalized offense. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on the Dash 2s.
Thank you. Mr. McDonough. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonnell. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I run the drug units, and I've done so for about 12 years. The Dash 2 amendments address a technical omission that occurred when the all the drug laws were broken down into different statutes back in 2005. It used to be all the different ones were alleged on 475, 840, but to track the different types of drugs and whether or not there was increases or decreases in particular type of activity, they were broken down to separate statutes for all the different ways that you could commit the crime for manufacture, delivery, and possession. So when that happened, the marijuana statute, because it has some unique peculiarities, no one classified delivery of marijuana for no consideration. Delivery for consideration, as little as, you know, any detectable amount, is a B felony, but delivery for less than an ounce is a misdemeanor. There's no classification for delivery, no consideration, so you could deliver a ton of marijuana, and nobody really knows what the classification of that crime should be. Then some litigation about it. Some judges treat delivery for no consideration as a felony, some as a misdemeanor, and this bill would just clarify what the classification should be.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Can, for us non-lawyers, could you tell us what no consideration means?
Anything of value. It's usually money, but it can be sex. It could be property. It can be anything that people place a value upon.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions?
I have a question.
Counsel.
Mr. McDonald, is it in your opinion, by making this change to the law, will there be any increase in prosecutions?
None whatsoever. And actually, I think we'll save money because we'll avoid litigation on what the classification should be.
My understanding is that this change would be a level 2 on the grid. Can you just briefly touch upon whether that would require greater supervision costs or prison?
It would be presumptive probation for all levels across the board, regardless of the number of prior convictions you have.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 2285.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
I move that Dash 2s be included in House Bill 2285.
Representative Westman moves the Dash 2s for House Bill 2285 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2285.
Next item on the agenda is a public hearing, open public hearing on House Bill 2738.
House Bill 2738 provides that disabled or abandoned vehicles taken into custody by a public body will be sold or disposed of by the person engaged to tow the vehicle. We do not yet have a fiscal or revenue impact in that, and I'm hoping the committee members all have a copy of the revised staff measure summaries, which provide a bit more background.
Christy Meister, Brian Wallace, and
Mr. Chair, my name is John Powell, representing the Sheriffs of Oregon. If I might represent Mr. Elkins, too.
Okay. Where is it?
Oh, there it is. Mr. Elkins represents the tow truck operators. We've met before and come to an understanding that the bill in its current form is ready to go as soon as you get a fiscal. With me are representatives of the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office and the Marin County Sheriff's Office to give you the blow-by-blow on the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the Chief Civil Deputy at the Marin County Sheriff's Office located in Salem. I'm here today on behalf of Marion County Sheriff Russ Isham, Oregon Sheriffs for Action, and a lot of my colleagues around the state to testify in support of House Bill 2738, and I thank you for the opportunity once again. Written testimony has been submitted to be a part of the official record. Real quick, this bill provides for a vehicle that is towed as an abandoned or a hazardous vehicle to be disposed of by the person that tows or who engages in towing the vehicle. Currently, there's a duplication of efforts in that both a tow company and a law enforcement agency appraise these vehicles. These vehicles are, in most all circumstances, appraised fairly low because the type of vehicles that are usually left as abandoned or deemed a hazard are usually mechanically and or structurally unsound. In these cases, the vehicle is either dismantled or it's eventually signed over to the tow company. The tow company usually throws away the sheriff's or law enforcement agency's certificate of sale because the vehicle can only receive a salvaged or branded title with that certificate. So tow companies get a clean title when they go through their lien process under possessory chattel liens in ORS Chapter 87, So naturally, they apply for title using that mechanism. So therefore, our appraisals of these vehicles is, in a sense, worthless. And at this time, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague from Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, and after she's done, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Please.
Okay. Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Meister. I'm the Chief Civil Deputy of the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, located in Newport, Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of my sheriff, Dennis L. Dotson, Oregon Sheriffs for Action, and a lot of the colleagues around the state to testify in support of House Bill 2738, and I thank you all for this opportunity. I agree with and support what my colleague has to say. I wish to add that this bill does not change the notice or due process requirements that are made to a registered or legal owner that their vehicle has been towed, other than the agency that's exercised their authority to take the vehicle into custody is responsible for providing the notice in the hearing. And I'm open to any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I found this, not being previously familiar with this chapter of the ORS's, I found this bill very difficult, and I'm not sure that I fully understood it. So I had a couple of hopefully baseless questions. Hopefully that there's nothing to my questions. Throughout the bill, there were several changes to underlying statutes, and because we're modifying it, a concern I had is because the bill, it seemed as applied, it went through, we were modifying through Chapter 819.215, and my concern was by only doing that and not 220, that we might be actually restricting these changes only to vehicles valued at $500 or less, if that makes any sense. Fairly technical point, I know, and perhaps it'd be best to take the discussion offline. We can follow up later, lest we get mired in sort of the technicalities of the statute. Also, I noticed on page 7, section 9, subsection 5, that we're changing essentially the refund process from 819.260 to Chapter 87. I was wondering why that is, because we're leaving 260 intact. Again, these are fairly technical. Perhaps it's best we discuss it later.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I can hopefully give you somewhat of a good answer. Throughout the state, it is 99.9% rare that any of these vehicles actually go to a public auction, just because, like I said before, the types of vehicles that are left abandoned upon a public right-of-way are junk vehicles, and hence they're appraised low. So what our contention is that if the tow truck companies, and if we have a public sale, let's just say that a vehicle is appraised at more than $500, or actually it would be more than a couple thousand dollars when you go through the public sale, nobody really shows up to those sales anyway, and it ends up ultimately going back to the tow company for their towing and storage of the vehicle. So really, what we're doing is pretty much a waste of time, and there's certainly a fiscal impact to my office specifically of about $10,000 a year, $10,000 that we can apply to services that are slowly crumbling because of the economy. So I hope that can kind of answer.
Just to clarify, so 99.9% of the vehicles that you actually reclaim along public right-of-way are valued at $500 or less, and that is why you only made the changes through 819.215 and not 220. That's what I took away from that, which answers my question, if that's accurate.
Representative Martin, no, that's not what I'm saying. Those that are valued at $500 or less have to be dismantled if they're abandoned. And so you can't sell those because we don't want, I mean, the way that the law is currently written, you don't want junk vehicles going back onto the road and being abandoned again and wasting public funds to have them towed again and so on and so forth by the police. So there's processes for, depending on if the if it's assessed at under $1,000 or more than $500, under $500, whether or not it needs to go to sale, a public sale, if it's and how long it needs to be advertised, if it's more than $2,000. What we're proposing is just doing away with all of that because, we never go to a public sale, usually. Like I said, 99.9% of the time. So I hope that that's kind of what you're looking at.
I just have the sense somehow, it's crazy, I know that not everyone else on the committee is intrigued by this chapter and the Oregon Revised Statutes as I, and I'd be happy to, I'd like to actually chat later.
Sure, it's not that intriguing for us either.
I know where you're at. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If what I'm hearing correctly, so cars are impounded by the tow company, the tow company ends up disposing of them in the end, and you're saying the sheriff doesn't want to be involved in that any more than they absolutely need to be. You provide the notice and everything, but these cars end up being sold by either sold or dismantled by the tow company.
Correct.
Scrapped. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Chair Barker, that's correct.
Representative Stigler.
My only concern, and I sort of ended up where Representative Barton was flipping through statute book.
Confused.
Yeah. And I just want to make sure we're not making this situation, and again, I kept trying to crosswalk all this stuff. We're bouncing back and forth to a variety of statutes. I don't want us ending up making the kinds of situations that we've seen happen up in Portland recently that hit the news, that makes that situation, because what we're essentially doing is relegating all of this over to these tow companies. And, you sort of confirmed a little bit of what made my stomach hurt a little bit here today, and I realize these are the low-value abandoned vehicle kinds of things, and there's always the but situation, so...
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, that is something that we discussed at length given the last session and the requirements that were placed on the tow companies for, quote, poaching up in the Portland metro area of lots. This has nothing to do with that. In fact, there are mechanisms in place to police, in a sense, towing businesses that would not do right by the changes in this law, and that is anywhere from filing a complaint to the Better Business Bureau, taking up small claims suit, or revoking their appraiser certificates. So I am very confident that would not come into play, any of those concerns that were changed by law last session. So.
Mr. Chair, again, John Powell, for Sheriffs of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I believe the statutory scheme here does not limit the statute to values of under $500. Section 16, or ORS 819-215, is if in the case a car in this scheme is valued under $500. I don't think it's exclusive or limits in any way other sections of the law. So I think that's okay. We'll look at that again and get back to Representative Barton on that issue for sure.
And Mr. Chair, just I candidly admit that much of my confusion is with, frankly, the existing statutory framework.
Yeah.
And being that I don't fully understand that, I had a hard time understanding how you're proposing to change it.
I understand.
Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
Yeah, Christy, probably more directed for you, the question, since, your sheriff used to be the station commander over there and everything. Was the state police over at Newport office doing this at that time, if you remember?
No. Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, in Lincoln County currently, and this is something that we discussed at length, too, because it's being done differently throughout the state now. It used to be back in the 70s and the 80s. Lincoln County Sheriff's Office used to get all the paperwork from the state police. Mm-hmm. And then we would process that, send out letters, and go through this long process. And a lot of time, we had to make phone calls to try to clarify, because they had the original files, made the original calls for the tows. In the last several years, in fact, I think back even dating to when current Sheriff Dotson was the lieutenant of the patrol office in Newport, That process stopped. So the local OSP office in Newport basically gives us copies of their letters that they send, so that in case it comes up for hearing, because the sheriff still is tasked under the statute for doing the hearings as law currently exists. And so that's what they do. They do their own mailings, and they basically take the whole process, except for they provide us with a copy of their letter. Now, that's not what's being done necessarily in every state patrol office. I know, I believe I'm... understand that Linn County, the OSP office, provides all their paperwork to the Linn County Sheriff's Office for processing. But it's done differently throughout the state, even though the statute governs a certain process.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the intent for the police agencies here, but my question from the consumer point of view is who determines disabled and abandoned? I don't read that in the statute. Is it 2 days or 3 days, or does the police put the yellow sticker on it and say it's been abandoned? Or who makes that determination, and what is that determination?
Actually, Representative Wisnett, the statute right now exists that 24 hours a vehicle is identified then as a vehicle that can be removed, as long as it's been tagged and there's notification to that.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the police, but a police officer would put that 24-hour sticker on there. So then the towing company they have the authority to come in and get it.
Or the towing company would be directed by the agency to respond to that vehicle and remove it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this actually.
Mr. Chair, I was only kidding when I said I was speaking for Al Elkins. I think he did want to go on the record.
Okay. Mr. Elkins,
this does make sense.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me today is Mr. Mike Wagner, a real person who owns a towing company at 10 a.m. Enterprises in 10 a.m. Lyons area, and is a past president and chairman of the board of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support the basic concept of 2738. We have a very good relationship with the law enforcement, especially the two individuals that are here speaking today, and we would like to continue that relationship, and I know we will. We would like to work with the committee on making this a better bill and answering some of the questions that were brought up previously, and we'll do anything we can with that. When we met with the group that spoke prior, we asked, will the authority still notify the owner that the vehicle has been towed? And we were told that yes, they would, and we would like to put that on record so that I know that Mr. Wagner can answer some of the questions that were asked previously, if you would like that to happen, Mr. Chair.
That'd be fine. Appreciate it. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mike Wagner. I'm with with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I own Sandy. I'm towing up in Lyons. Did anybody have one that didn't get cleared up before?
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad that you didn't have to tow me yesterday. Your Representative Stigler coming from the Sandy end of it.
We only do good guy towing, that helps any of us.
I didn't end up in any ditches. Speak for yourself.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2738.
Good guy.
And open a public hearing on House Bill 2751.
House Bill 2751 requires the Department of Corrections to supervise work crews operating outside of a custodial facility, and it sets minimum number of correction officers that must be present. It's my understanding there is an amendment on the way that testimony will cover. We do not yet have the fiscal or revenue for this.
Thank you. Roger Ware and Mary Botkin.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. House Bill 2751 was introduced at the request of several of our officers who actually work with inmate work crews. And I've asked Roger Ware, one of our officers from Shutter Creek down in Coos Bay, to come up today to offer testimony sort of from the direct perspective. This bill was originally introduced a couple of sessions ago as a direct result of a phone call that Senator Larry George received, as did I, from a young woman who was working for the Department of Forestry in Eastern Oregon, and she and an intern from the University of Oregon were working together up in whatever forest is outside of the Grand. Now, is it? Okay. I don't. Anyway, you know, as a native Oregonian, I should know these things, and I don't. Anyway, she was working as a forest ranger, and she got a call one day from the forestry department and was informed that she would be in charge of an inmate work crew. The inmate work crew were 10 inmates from the Powder River facility there in La Grande, and she didn't want to take an inmate work crew of 10 men to a rural remote area in the forest with her intern, another young woman, and she called the senator and myself to ask if she had to do that. And she was told later that she did have to do it, and when she asked me what she was supposed to do if the inmates wanted her truck, I told her to give the keys to the inmates. And not to try to be heroic, but just simply let them have the truck and call for help. But it brought about the problem that we had, which was she had no security training, and in the eight-hour training that she was given, most of the training was dedicated to the inmate rights, what she could and could not expect the inmates to do, what she should and should not do with the inmates. And there was very little consideration given to her about her own personal safety. And that was sort of the beginning of the bill. And over the last few sessions, more and more of our inmate work crew supervisors or folks that we represent who work with the inmate crews, work crews, have come forward with more and more concerns. And I am not going to wander off on this for any longer. I'm going to let Roger talk about it. He's the one who works with these folks every day. He knows the issue better than I, and I will just sit back in case you need me to help answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Board. Thank you for allowing me to come here and speak today. My name is Roger Ware. I'm a correctional officer down at Shutter Creek Correctional Institution. I've currently been with the Department of Corrections for over 11 years, the last seven of which have been down at Shutter Creek supervising work crews. The training that I receive to supervise inmates, I have to go through a five-week academy class and be certified by DPSST. To keep that certification, I have to go through a 40-hour training course every year to maintain that certification. That certification allows me to supervise inmates inside of a secure facility. Before I can take inmates off on an off-site work crew, I have to go through an 8-hour class once a year that touches some of the high points on things that are specific to outside work crews. DOC does not allow our trial service staff or staff members that are security staff that are on the probationary period to escort inmates off-site. Even though they have the same training I have, they cannot escort them off-site until after they've completed their probationary period or trial service period. Non-DOC staff training basically consists of just that 8-hour class that I have for off-site work crews. They have no experience in dealing with the inmates most of the time before they come and take this class. They have no practical knowledge or experience to draw upon should problems arise on their work crew. Basically, this class that we take, that's an 8-hour class, consists of, like she was saying, inmate rights, basically what the inmates have a right to be expected to do on a work crew and what they don't have a right to be expected to do, dealing with like OSHA laws and whatnot.
They go over what the inmates have to have as far as safety equipment, depending on the crew or the work they're going to be doing. It covers the conflicts with outside agencies or personnel, basically letting them know if you go into a work site and you have a conflict with either the public or another agency, how you're to handle that, which basically consists of bringing the crew back to the institution. It touches briefly on escapes and walkaways, basically what you're supposed to do with an escape or walkaway, where they tell them that if you have an inmate walkaway, take account of the remainder of your inmates, look in the immediate area, and if you do not see the inmate, roll the rest of the inmates up, call the control center, and report back to the institution, at which time that you call the control center, they'll also notify the local law enforcement personnel. It touches on medical emergencies, what they need to do if there's a medical emergency that arises. Basically, it's called the institution again, where we can contact the local 911 and get medical agencies rolling. And it goes over basically defensive driving, you know, how to move your crew from where you pick them up to the area in which they're going to work. It also touches a little bit on counts, which are our institution counts. Whenever you have an inmate work crew outside the institution, you still have to have accountability of them. So we fill out what's called an outcount form. These outcount forms are actually filled out and verified by our security staff prior to the inmates leaving the institution. At that time, at Shutter Creek specifically, that outcount sheet has not only a signature of the crew supervisor, it's going to have the crews with them, but also the security staff. So there again, the security has to get involved. We do understand that this is going to raise the cost of crews. Through the figures that I've gathered, pretty much for Shutter Creek itself, it's going to raise the cost per crew by $530 to $550 per crew a day. Now, this cost is going to be borne by the agency that wants the crew. That agency is paying between $6 and $7 a head or an inmate for the crew that day. This would add that $530 to $550 cost on top of that. We do understand there is a cost to go with this. However, the problems that have arisen at SCCI off-site work crews that have been supervised by non-security staff are abundant. Everything from it's increased the contraband introduction into our institution, things are not authorized to come inside of our institution, such as tobacco and whatnot. Inmates aren't necessarily supervised as well as if you had a DOC security staff. Through my training, I'm required to keep a log of a minimum of every 30 minutes doing a physical head count of my inmates and documenting that on a log, at which time I turn that log in to my supervisor when I get back from my work crew, and it goes to my security manager to make sure I'm doing my checks. These off-site or these non-security personnel are not required to do those logs. They're not required to show any type of documentation at our institution that they actually do these checks. It has been observed where inmates have been up to a half mile away from the supervisor that they are supposed to be with by our staff. You know, we've gone to local areas such as the Port of Bandon, who come in and take out a work crew on their own with no security staff. These inmates are then allowed pretty much to work on the docks downtown Bandon, which is a highly populated area of tourism and the local populace. At the time they're on the docks, their supervisor has been commonly up to a half mile away from them inside of a building. I cannot say to how often they go down and check them because, there again, we don't have the logs to show how often they go down and check them. On that same crew, we've had inmate liaisons with the general public, i.e. they have contacted their spouse or their significant other and have met up with them in public bathrooms to have intimate contact with them. We've had then meet up with the public to receive contraband, such as tobacco and whatnot, to bring back into our institution. We believe that would be dramatically reduced if we had DOC security personnel that are trained to handle that. We've had walkaways from these crews without DOC personnel. In fact, since the time I've been at Shutter Creek, which is the last 7 years, I know of every walkaway, with the exception of one that we have had, off of the off-site work crews has been from the non-security side of the house. From the inmates are being supervised by non-security personnel. One of those actually entered the local town of Lakeside, where he broke into a house, stole clothing, and then robbed a local financial institution there. There again, I'd like to thank you for the time to testify before this committee. If anybody has any questions, I'll answer them the best I can. Thank you.
Thank you for coming all the way out here, too. We appreciate that, and it's good to hear from somebody that actually does the job. While you're well represented, it always helps to actually No,
thank you.
The guy that does the job. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to underline this is important not just for the safety of the staff and the community, but it's really in the best interest of the inmate, too. It's not that we don't trust the inmates, it's just we don't want them to put their hand in the cookie jar. And if there's that kind of structure, it makes it less likely that they'll do something stupid like run, and they're always caught, or
well,
almost always.
Go with that. There are times that we have inmates from our local communities that are on our crews, and these inmates have been in the public light as not necessarily the nicest people in the world. So if you have security staff there, we are in uniform, we're easily identifiable. It does reduce the potential of having the public retaliate against inmates by having the security staff there. I mean, it's an added assurance for not only us but the inmate.
Thank you. Any other further questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mary, this could be more for you. My first question is, what's the ratio of inmate corrections officer right now compared to other states?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I will absolutely get it for you and bring it to your office.
Okay, and then a follow-up
please.
Question. Why would this not be something that would be addressed on a policy issue within the agency rather than moving through it statutorily?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, it absolutely could be done by policy rather than statutorily. There seems to be some reluctance to do so. If I can just say that I think inmate work crews bring great value to our communities when they're needed. All you have to do is ask the folks up in the Vernonia area during the windstorm and consequent floods how much help those inmates were to those residents in restoring some sort of semblance of community there. And with the passage of Ballot Measure 17, we strongly support the use of inmate work crews. The question is, how secure do you keep the environment? And do you do it in a way that makes some sort of sense to the community? Now, we have an amendment to the bill that will take out the ratio, the 2-to-10 ratio, and just simply state that the department shall provide security supervision for all inmate work crews. And that is, you know, we do not expect the department to support it even with that amendment, but it is our effort to sort of show that we understand that the ratios creates an undue burden on everybody. But at some level, you need to have some security staff with your inmate work crews. I mean, it just doesn't make sense not to. So, but I will get the ratio to you as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Boykin, who you said $7, or the officer said $7 per day, per hour per inmate?
Not per hour, sir, per day.
Per day. Thank you.
That's the high end right now. Now, this, mind you, this is Shutter Creek specific. I can't speak to the other institutions because I don't have anything to do with them.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, does Department of Correction or the Park and Recs, and this, we have a letter from Park and Recs, and so would they give that money to corrections? Is that how it's transferred?
It depends on which crew you're talking about. If it's from Shutter Creek, it depends on, we have two different crews that work for the Parks Department of Shutter Creek. We have one crew that's from our AIP program or the Summit program, and one crew that's from our general population. The general population crew, there again, is I believe he said $7 a head per inmate per day. For the AIP program, they don't pay. They pay, it's a $535 flat rate. They pay for a work crew of 7 to 10 inmates, minimum of 7, maximum of 10. And I believe that funding goes back into the work crew program.
And the work group program will provide the shovels and the gloves and those kind of things?
Yeah, it provides the shovels, the gloves, the transportation. And
okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Gower?
Please go ahead. Chair Bakker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'm here to discuss today with you the effects of House Bill 2751 on the department and our partners in the community. Some background information. DOC began dispatching work crews into our community as a result of passage Measure 17 in November of 1994. We successfully deployed hundreds of inmates each day at the height of our work crew activity, utilizing current supervision ratio, one officer, corrections officer, to 10 inmates. During June of 2008, we had an average of 932 inmates working on our crews each day. During our slow season, we had more than 350 inmates on our work crews. Over the past several years, we've had very few instances of inmate walking away from our work crew assignments. During this past year in 2008, we had four inmates out of 7,787 inmates walk away from our crews. What this bill does, the HB 2751 requires the inmate work crews outside of our correctional facilities to be supervised by a DOC corrections officer. This bill specifically requires two officers to supervise our work crew of 10 inmates. Further, it requires both officers to keep an eye on our inmates, which we call a line of sight at all times. This bill specifically exempts the Oregon Correctional Enterprise employees in reference to this bill. Concerns raised by this bill: while most work crews are supervised by Department of Corrections officers, some agencies that partner with DOC have been trained by the department to supervise their own inmate work crews at a cost savings. The Department of Forestry, the Oregon Military Department, State Parks, Port of Bannon, to name a few, are our partners and host agencies that supervise our inmate work crews in the community. This bill would require DOC to increase its staffing levels in order to provide supervision of all our work crews, creating a substantial financial impact to many of our partners and host agencies. Additionally, many of our host agency inmate work crews perform specialized work assignments where they use power equipment like chainsaws and jackhammers. If DOC were required to supervise all these crews, we would have to provide specialized training to our officers to ensure the equipment is properly handled. This bill would require two officers to supervise each crew, which is double our current standard for our non-host agency as well as department. House Bill 2751 impacts our work crew supervision by requiring officers to keep every inmate in line of sight at all times. Currently, our corrections officers are trained to move about the work area systematically, checking on the inmates at intervals during the work day. By requiring a line of sight supervision, both our officers and the inmates would be crowded together into an insufficient distribution of work. This requirement would be especially problematic for our firefighting, forest efforts, and disaster relief projects. The fiscal impact, which was sent, Chair Barker, and probably en route to this committee, in order for DOC to comply with this bill, we've estimated we'd need about 84.87 FTE for our community work crew supervision. So these are all the crews that currently go out into the community that are with our host agency as well as our DOC-supervised work crews. An additional 46.42 FTE crews to perform our maintenance and support functions for our DOC units outside of our correctional institutions. We have several inmate work crews that help support and perform maintenance and support, like taking care of the dome building where they have maintenance and janitorial duties, as well as inmate work labor down at our CDC and so forth. We also state that approximately 8.71 FTE would be needed to provide additional supervision during our seasonal work crews, such as providing supervision at our Deschutes Mobile Work Camp and to provide assistance for the wildland firefighting effort. These additional costs would be estimated at about $15.6 million per biennium and would have an inevitable impact on our work crews for our counties, municipalities, state agencies, and others who contract work for our inmate work crews. Between the inefficiencies caused by the line of sight requirement and the increased cost, agencies may not be able to engage with as many inmate work crews, which would adversely affect department's compliance with Measure 17 and also contribute to our inmate idleness issue. How this bill changes the current law, the bill would define in statute the ratio of officers to inmates required when inmate work crews are dispatched into our community. And the requirement for these officers to keep a line of sight on all these the inmates at all times. These changes are already addressed in the Department of Corrections Oregon Administrative Rules, which have weight of law in department practice.
Okay, thank you. I understood Ms. Botkin to say that they were going to amend this so they didn't have a strict number of officers and try to work with you on some of the other issues. I would assume that would change quite a bit of that, like the number of new people, number of FTEs and so on.
Chair Barker, yes, that would cut down probably a percentage of the supervision issues. That still would be an impact on us in reference to how DOC handles the operations outside our corrections facilities. Our facilities, other than the one in Pendleton and EO Correctional Institution, our inmates support the outside maintenance of our facilities too. So once the inmate work crews go out to cut lawn or to provide services outside that facility, that would impact us.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How you doing?
Chair Baca, Representative Olson, very well.
The one stat that you have in here is kind of interesting. During 2008, four inmates out of 7,787 that walked away. Can you describe to me what the eligibility factors are and then the screening processes to become a member of the work crew?
Chair Baca, Representative Olson, yes. You have to be a minimum custody inmate, otherwise a classified one. We have three different classifications. We have inside work crews in reference to inmates who are eligible to be classified as a one or a two. We have on-site inmate work crews that would work maybe outside the fence, but they're on the site of the correctional facility. So if you went by the Oregon Penitentiary on the grounds, that would be on site. And then you have community where they actually leave the correctional facility and work into the community. We have a WHALE program where the information in reference to the inmates classification, if you're a one or two, then there's several entities that they have to make in reference to the classification. The fourth piece on that is our unfenced minimum qualifications. That's for at Mill Creek and at South Fork, where there is no boundaries and no fence to hold the inmates in. You have to be in the Department of Corrections custody for more than 60 days. You can't have any convictions for arson. You can't have any stalking orders. You can't have any restraining orders. There's a list of requirements in reference to the inmates being screened to actually go out into the community. There is the ability for the on-site factor in reference to inmates staying on the correctional facility for the superintendent to do an override in reference to allowing someone to go out into the community. But serious personal crimes, sex offenders, they're not allowed to work into the community.
Thank you.
Thank you for your questions. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gower, on your second page, the physical impact, all those FTEs, DOC is going to be reimbursed for half of them. I mean, what are we talking about here as far as, you know, you're giving us a lot of FTEs, and that's justifying your $15 million, but some of that's going to be paid by cities, counties, other park and recs, and whoever, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, that would be correct. For our host communities, the ones like forestry, ODOT, military, those would be, yes, reimbursed. But the ones that the minimum, the 46, the second one, the 46 FTE, and some of the ones that work in the community, those are the ones that would be affecting DOC in reference to their funding.
Can, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I guess it was Representative Olson. I mean, I don't know why we have this. It's obviously you're having trouble reaching compromise with your employees and I don't know that we should be involved in that. I think the people, when they passed Measure 17, wanted to utilize this workforce, but they also didn't want to jeopardize the community safety. And I think, you know, if you've got 10 out there and they're all, you know, good boys, then that's one thing. But if, you know, maybe we'd need to look at this ratio or something, but it looks like you could work out a compromise or something determining the level of people you have out there as far as ratios and something or more officers. But I think that I'm concerned, Mr. Chair, with the safety and would like to, you know, see if we do need to address this.
Representative Spiegler.
Mr. Gower, how would you characterize the training that is given to non-correction staff as far as supervision over these work crews?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, the eight-hour training is something that has gone on, you know, for the better part of since it's the inception of this program. I think the corrections officer, Mr. Ware, did an excellent job describing that. During that 8 hours, we tried to give them as much information to deal with the inmates in reference to the inmate, if you want to say the inmate games or behaviors in which they'll try to compromise the staff. We try to educate them. Again, it's an eight-hour class when they first start out, and we ask that it gets renewed every year, or if there are issues with our host partners, is that it gets addressed and they have some remedial training.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So there's no control through DOC of who within these partner agencies might become a supervisor, or do you have a list of criteria that the person has to meet if they're going to be one of the people supervising one of these work crews?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, that is working with the host agency. Yeah, we don't have direct say in reference to who they're going to choose. Forestry, for example, hires their folks, and we're the ones that assist them in training when they choose who they deem appropriate to supervise the crews.
So what I'm really trying to get to here, do you have a basic set of criteria that you prescribe to the partner agencies that the people need to fit at least these sort of minimum criteria, or you leave that to the host agent or the partner agency to make that determination of who they think might be appropriate, and then you provide the training?
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, I think your second would be more correct in reference to having it outlined.
Final follow-up. Last question here, Mr. Gower. Any consideration that if this kind of that perhaps maybe you need a little bit more comprehensive training of these folks? I mean, the fact that it's what's been in place for 8 years, it doesn't necessarily speak to it being the appropriate thing. It's just what's been done.
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, you know, I would agree. Anytime you can get more training, that would always benefit, absolutely. We just haven't seen a systems breakdown out of the four that escaped last year. One was from a host agency, and three were from DOC supervised. The one that was from the host agency was working at the food bank up in Portland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Were those inmates all recovered?
Representative Barker and Representative Cameron, yes, they are all back in custody.
And just in hearing all the testimony so far, it would be my thought that it's certainly better to have a correctional officer out there with them. And because I have faith in your selection of correction officers, I don't know how the Port of Bandon selects. So I hope you'll be able to work out some kind of a compromise and come back to us with a program between you and your workers that will work. That may improve this, or maybe we can't, but I hope we'll be able to try that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not a real fan of regulating or creating policy for an agency through statute. I mean, I understand what, you know, Representative Wisdom was trying to get with the issue dealing with safety as well. You have somebody like Roger Ware, who's been a member of Department of Corrections for 11 years, and I know also Mike Gower here, the position that he's got in his history and everything, to somehow be able to just work and develop something policy-wise to get where they need to go rather than this. I mean, that's what I would prefer.
Thank you, Representative Olson. That, you know, maybe that would be the way this will end eventually, but...
Mr. Chair, four out of 7,000 and something. That's a better record than the legislators being absent from this building.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. Fishing. Thank you very much, Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. Smith?
No, I'm okay.
Okay, thanks. Next call. It looks like Paul Bell and Gordon Dana, maybe, and Mike Deitzel. Please go ahead and just say whoever you want to start, introduce yourself for the record as it's recorded. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Paul Bell, Chief of Fire Protection for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And to my left is Gordon Dana, who is our South Fork camp manager. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 2751. The Department of Forestry uses Department of Corrections inmate work crews for both wildland firefighting and forest management activities. House Bill 2751 would require that each inmate work crew be supervised by two corrections officers. Currently, ODF staff with Department of Corrections training supervise forestry inmate crews, providing significant savings to the department and to the state. Additionally, ODF supervisors and staff have already trained and kept current in national firefighting standards, required national firefighting standards, and or OSHA forest activity rules, both of which require significant technical qualifications. House Bill 2751 also would require that both officers keep all inmates on the work crew in a line of sight at all times. Direct line of supervision is feasible in parks and on highway shoulders during litter cleanup and other similar activities. However, crew activities in forest management, prescribed fire, wildfire suppression, and hiking trail construction cannot be accomplished effectively or efficiently with direct line of sight supervision standards. Or OSHA rules require that forest activity workers do not create a hazard for one another. Therefore, in all of our activities, the law requires that we position workers away from each other to safely accomplish the work, especially during tree felling where the minimum distance is two tree lengths. Direct line of sight supervision at all times is not feasible for a lot of forest activities. House Bill 2751 would increase the size and cost of the state government with no direct benefit to the state. Department of Corrections, working with other partnering agencies, has achieved a functional balance between inmate crews supervised by security staff and host agency staff. This bill simply adds to the operating costs of a very effective inmate work programs that we have with no direct benefit. The Department of Forestry's preference would be that this bill not become law. If the committee feels otherwise, we would request the opportunity to propose amendments to the bill to reduce conflicts with existing law and provide practical exemptions would apply to inmate work crews in forestry situations. Thank you for your time and considerations, and both Gordon and I would be more than pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, Representative Greer?
Forestry. Have you had many of them try to run off from those that part of the program?
Chair Barker, Representative Krager, I'll defer to Gordon.
Chair Barker, Representative Krager. My name is Gordon Dana. I'm the manager of South Fork Camp. I've had the privilege of serving the state of Oregon there for nearly 28 years and directly involved with inmate work programs from running, supervising inmate crews through working up toward management of our inmate work program. The escape rate from South Fork facility over the years has progressively improved from changes in inmate classification through changes in the quality and amount of training that we provide to forestry crew supervisors, as well as creation of a specific classification for the Department of Forestry, and that the class that supervises the inmates is Forest Inmate Crew Coordinator. So in the last 5 years, we've had one escape from South Fork Camp, May of 2008, and that was from the facility proper, not from a field work crew.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Our members basically are the end result use of coordination with the Oregon Department of Forestry. Basically, my testimony, if you read it, it looks just like Mr. Bell's here, and we didn't talk beforehand, so I won't bore the committee with the same arguments.
Appreciate that.
But it has been an eye-opener. I remember testifying two sessions ago, and I guess Ms. Bodkin's story, it's the first time I've heard that. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but as I remember two sessions ago, it was a work crew in the Tualatin area that a member of the work crew had wandered away. That's the way I remember that, and that was part of our position then, is that the forestry sector had an excellent record and how difficult it was with line of sight considerations. So, okay. Thank you very much.
Chief Bell, I'd like to ask you something off a little different topic. I got several emails a while back, and I think it was a result of a Fox News broadcast that said that in Oregon, firefighting crew bosses have to be able to speak Spanish or they can't have the job. Is that true?
The news report was that the Department of Forestry had fired individuals because they could not speak Spanish, and that is not true. That was a false news story at the time, and it actually occurred in 2006, and for whatever reason, due to the power of the Internet, it resurfaces about every 6 months, and I get a lot of questions on it. So.
Okay, thank you. I did, too, and even from out of state, I mean, people were saying, is this true? And that's outrageous. And thank you for your answer.
Well, Mr. Chair, to clarify that was a thing I worked with on the Department of Forestry, and that we were being sure that the people they were hiring could speak English. I think it was the other way around, and that got misreported because we had crews that were being certified that had no one that could speak English.
Yeah.
And the crew chief, we said, had to be able to speak English. That was what we were working with the Department of Forestry on to be sure that was the case. I believe that was the case, Mr. Bell.
Chair Barker, Representative Wilson, just to be sure I'm clear, right, because I'm having a little hard time hearing.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
That's all right. English is a language of firefighting in the United States. We do hire a lot of contract crew resources that are used in Oregon, Washington, as well as west rest of the West. And we do require that if there are non-English speaking folks on the crew, that the crew supervisors must be able to speak English and converse in that language for safety, to keep those folks safe.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill. Well, before I do that, I'll say I hope there could be some consensus. And I think Representative Olson's comments were well taken, that sometimes things should be fixed without us trying to have a law that might be viewed as micromanaging an agency if it isn't absolutely necessary.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Smith.
Thanks. I want to say the thing I was going to say before in respectful response to my colleague. I agree that where possible we should be dealing with these in agencies, but just speaking to the record, where they're, and on the chance we will be dealing with more issues like that, it seems to me that as long as there is a rule of reasonability and rationality, as long as what the agency is doing of its own accord makes a lot of sense, then yeah, let them do it. But I wouldn't want us to have a habit of defanging ourselves in case agencies are going hog wild, whether it's in terms of spending or whether it's in terms of rules. And so I wanted to at least say that. So I also hope that we can come to some accord.
Does that apply to McCullough's too?
Thank you. Close the work session on 27. I'm sorry, public hearing on House Bill 2751.
When they get the resort,
we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2169.
Exactly. House Bill 2169 clarifies the sex offender reporting procedures. We first heard this on February 3rd. The Dash A amendments have been adopted.
or the dash one, I should say, there's a minimal expenditure and no revenue impact, and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means has been rescinded by the Speaker's office.
These are the same. Did we already adopt the dash one?
We did.
That's what I thought. I hadn't written it down.
Mr. Chair.
That's rare.
Representative Westnap.
I move that House Bill 2169 is amended. Be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Westnap moves House Bill 2169 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any question? Representative Shields.
Could Council just kind of update us again on what this bill does in her view?
Sure, let me update myself.
I thought we were going to get out early.
Oh, yes. This is one of the first bills we looked at in connection with the Walsh Act. And what this one did is place the onus on the sex offender to provide all the necessary information to complete the sex offender registration form.
Right.
Currently, the way the law is written, the person working at the registration unit is required to fill out a form. And there have been instances where an offender has come in and given him partial information or a business card, things like that. But because of the way the statute's written, technically they're not required to do more than show up and have somebody else fill out a form. So this requires them to provide all the necessary information and puts the onus on them.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm looking at the letter to the Speaker, and it said that the committee at the time passed the bill with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Did we pass this bill?
Yep.
I noticed that myself, and if it would be okay to ask.
I think we did.
Ms. Ransom Smith on the record. So, I'm not sure, honestly. I looked at the letter, and I thought that we had not. I thought we had simply adopted it.
Adopted the dash one.
But I did not draft the letter. So.
Should be in the legislative history, right?
Bet you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at the time the bill was heard, the dash ones, I believe, were adopted, and it was sent with the subsequent referral. At that time, we carried the bill over to rescind the referral to then send it as a due pass. So the letter should have said, yes, it was had a due pass two ways and means, but we're asking for a subsequent referral. To rescind the referral, sorry.
That makes sense.
Do we have to do a motion to rescind the referral and then pass it?
No, we already have done that, right?
Been approved to rescind it.
I think that simply the committee needs to agree to rescind, and you have agreed to de-pass to the floor.
It's not a vote to say no one objects to rescinding. No one objects to rescinding.
Yeah, is there any objection to the rescinding of the referral?
I think
referral ways of the
chair, this happened in another committee. I think the motion is to send it to the floor with a due pass and to rescind the referral to Ways.
What part of the motion? Okay. I amend my motion to include that. Thank you.
Right now. Yeah. Representative Wisnett amends the motion to include that.
Removing the referral to Ways and Means.
Any further discussion?
Thank you.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
I'm sure I'm an aye, but what are we putting
on? Okay, if I may clarify, yes. I believe this is a motion to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and to pass this to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That's right. Okay. Have we moved the amendment?
We did.
Yes, okay. That was positive of that.
Okay. I just want to make sure this was including to send it with a due pass to the floor.
It is.
As amended.
As amended in the rescission.
We just didn't do the first one.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Seeler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Good.
This is a technical fix, really. Would it be okay to put this in the consent calendar, or would somebody like to carry it?
I think we need to do it.
Do you need to carry it?
It's something to do with sex offenders.
Okay.
It probably should be.
Who would like to? Is there anybody who would like to be a carrier? Representative Olson. Motion carries.
We're meeting tomorrow night.
No, 31st.
Next week.
Not till the 31st.
Ah, good. My wife will be happy.
Not till the 31st?
You do have a meeting tomorrow,
so not this week
though.
Or next week?
At night. Not at night, no.
No, not for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Our work group?
2 weeks from tomorrow.
Just for
meeting. Adjourned.
Cool.
Not after. Not
Yahoo!
Second.